It's been rough going for the publishing industry recently, or so we keep hearing, but we've also seen some incredibly successful bestsellers, and it's clear that published books aren't about to disappear. Joining us now to talk about the publishing industry as a whole, and also more specifically about the boom in children's and young adult books in recent years, are Amy Einhorn, who worked as an editor at Farrar, Straus & Giroux, Villard, Grand Central Publishing, and others before she started her own eponymous imprint at Putnam, and Ben Schrank, who was the editorial director at Alloy Entertainment and a creative writing professor before he became the president of Razorbill, an imprint of Penguin Young Readers Group. He has also is a published writer, both adult and young adult fiction. I'm very pleased to welcome them to our show today. Hello.
Hi.
Amy, you sure began your imprint with a bang. The first book you published was The Help?
Yes.
Did you spot it immediately as a potential bestseller?
I don't know if I'd say I'd spotted it immediately as a bestseller. I spotted it as something that I loved. But I think any editor who says that they know a book is going to be a bestseller, I wouldn't believe them.
But you say that it was something that you loved. Is it important to love a book? Because I've seen any number of bestsellers that I know only a mother could love, or or somebody with a very weird political outlook could love. And yet, as a publisher, I might very well want to publish them.
I agree with you. I think the difference is that given that I was starting my own imprint and it was quite small and I wasn't able to sort of hide behind a very big list, it was very important to me that if I was going to be audacious enough to have my name on these books, that they all be books that I could stand behind and say, I love this book. So that was really important to me. And yes, there are books where I'll see and I'll say, I actually think this could be a bestseller, but it's not the kind of book that I should be publishing.
So you pass on it.
Yes.
The New York Observer said that you are the best when it comes to having that book sense. They wrote an article about you and your work. So is there something that makes a book stand out as a potential bestseller, even if it sometimes is not going to be one?
I think, and Ben can speak this too, we get so many submissions and you're just sort of deluged with stuff. And I think when you're reading something and if for whatever reason it speaks to you and it gives that spark to you, then I think, okay, if that does that to me, it'll help. That'll do it to other people.
So, Ben, are there specific markers that you look for?
I think the thing, yes, the marker that I look for is not, of course, you hope that anything that you're thinking about acquiring will sell like crazy and become a bestseller. But when we look at a novel with an eye toward acquiring it, I'm hoping that it is a story that is told in a way that I've never heard before. And the moment that I can say that and look at you or anyone else and say, I've never heard this story told in this way before, it makes it easy to acquire and then push it through toward publication.
Well, bestsellers aren't always the best books, or great books aren't always immediate bestsellers. But there's that, if you believe in a book, can you keep it in print longer than the rest of the company would like? And if you have a book that you really believe in and you go to the publicity department, they say, you know, we really don't think we want to put our resources behind this. We have some other books that we think might do better. How do you fight for it?
I think at least I can only speak for children's books in my own experience. But in some cases, I believe that the answer is yes, that when the whole division loves a novel and loves the author and feels that we are doing our very best for the book and for the author, we can keep pushing in relation to publicity and marketing and to some extent sales and see what we can get going.
Don't some years pass, or at least long months pass between deciding to publish a book and its actual publication, Amy?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, actually, I always tell my authors it's sort of like giving birth to a baby. So ideally, I want to have 10 months minimum between when they are finished editing with me and when we actually publish it, and ideally longer.
A friend was really upset about that. He's written a book which includes some things that are very topical. And then his publisher said, okay, well, we're going to put it out next year. And he felt that it's going to lose the special quality that it has that would make it something saleable. But why does it take so long? It doesn't take all that long to set type, does it?
It doesn't take – look, you could hand me in a manuscript today and we could publish it in a week. So it doesn't take long in terms of – I think there's a difference between putting out a book and publishing a book well. And what I'll say to my authors is, you know, once we finish working editorially, there's a whole nother part of the process which probably is invisible to most people, but which isn't invisible to Ben and myself, that goes on. And if you don't seed that all well, you can publish a book. Whether or not it actually then works is a whole nother story.
Are you talking about the marketing plan?
They're just, you know, there are thousands and thousands of books that are published, many of them by Penguin. And so for Ben and I to get a book attention within house, which it starts with, to then, you know, it all starts at the beginning where if I can't get the book attention within house, how am I going to get it attention when it goes out to the marketplace? So if I just rush something into production, I need to seed everything. I need to go to my key salespeople and say, I have this manuscript. I want you to read it because I need you to fall in love with it. And then they're going to start talking. And then it becomes this domino effect. But every time I've had a book where I've waited a long time to publish, not every time, I shouldn't say that. The books I've had that have worked have been books where I have taken a longer time to publish them.
Ben, is being able to predict the market even more important when you're working with children's books?
I wouldn't say it's more important with children's books. I think one of the things that we
for example, Good Night Moon. Yeah. You know, nobody could have predicted that thing was going to have its in the kind of enduring quality that it's had when it was published how many years ago, and yet. When you realize that it's had that kind of impact, I mean, you read the book and you say, well, of course.
Right. Well, that's obviously the pleasure of hindsight. One of the things that I like to do is to speak not to predicting the market, but and this was hopefully still true in children's books, is that we want to be able to make the market, is that we're like Goodnight Moon, if we're absolutely new and fresh with something that we hope that will, perhaps because of our very young readers who are not have not trained themselves to read in one genre or another, that if we're so new and different with a book that we put out there, we can literally make or create a market for that book.
But children's books covers young adult books as well, does it?
Yeah.
Does it make sense to mix Lemony Snicket with the Hunger Games?
Well, the children's books is broken into three categories, is picture books, what's called middle grade, and what's called young adult. So there is a divide between Lemony Snicket in the traditionally, as I understand it, in the bookstore and the Hunger Games. But the pleasure for me in the past 5 years, certainly in the YA arena, is that anything that you call YA, which is for readers, let's say, in ranging age from, say, 11 or 12 to end up to 17, hopefully transitioning to adult, is that anything can sit in that part of the bookstore together. So we could share. So a girl or boy who's reading the Hunger Games might also read Coming of Age, traditional grounded YA novel.
But I assume there's an awful lot of copycat involved. Vampires were big last year. This year is all about dystopian futures.
Right.
And I would think that most publishers noting the trend would want to publish similar books. How do you stay above the trend or ahead of the trend?
What I always say is that we want to be – I'd rather be sort of apart from the trend, be first and win, or just be completely off and, you know, fall on my sword and have that dignity attached to that experience. So we have a book coming out this fall called Origin, which is a girl. It was a story that I had never heard before, about a girl raised in the Amazon by scientists, and she's immortal, and she has to understand how she's been raised that way. And she has to figure out the dark secret of what's been going on in this terrible setting. And the key thing for me that made us jump at the book and really fall in love with it and believe in it was that it was a very young author who had written a story that I had never seen told that way before.
Now, Judy Blume had a nice career never writing about immortals or wizards or anything.
Right.
Is that approach dead now?
I hope not. I mean, I think we were always – I'm always looking for an amazing, what we call grounded in sort of a Judy Blume's reality novel. And we always have room for those on my list.
And then you have to deal with the censors. But that's a whole other issue. Amy, the Pulitzer Committee didn't award a prize for fiction this year. Are booksellers more concerned about that than publishers?
No, I wouldn't say so. I think all of us are looking for opportunities to promote books, and that was obviously a great – of all the prizes, that's the most selling prize. So I think everybody was pretty upset about it.
Barnes & Noble only stocks books that they think will sell. Are they stocking all of the Pulitzer finalists or
I would have assumed when they were shortlisted they would have stocked them, so yes. And also I don't think Barnes & Noble is alone in only stocking books that they can sell. I think most bookstores do that.
Really? Even the locals? I mean, not books that they can sell, but some, at least the independent bookstores claim that they fall in love with a book and that they push it even if it isn't something that's on the New York Times bestseller list.
Well, I think there's a distinction between just because it's not on the list doesn't mean that they don't think they can sell it. I mean, I think at the end of the day, if they fall in love with it, they therefore think they can sell it. So I think just because something's not on the bestseller list, and I think it's sort of arbitrary.
Well, what about those bestseller lists? The New York Times Book Review used to have 2 pages of bestseller lists. Now, seems to me you get very few reviews and a lot
pages
of lists,
and, yeah.
And they all duplicate each other. There's minor differences between this kind of I'm not even sure I understand some of the distinctions. Does it really – who does that matter to? Because it sure doesn't matter to me, except once in a while I look and I see how many of the authors have been on the show, and if there have been a lot, I feel good about myself. But I don't think most readers who read the New York Times Book Review care.
Certainly it's true. For children's books that we don't necessarily say that hitting the New York Times list is great for readers, but we get so few sort of markers – of affirmation in our business, except for the numbers and great reviews, which don't always equate with sales, that this is one that we can – every week we can see it. It's a great pat on the back to know that your book is on there. It feels terrific.
And it also, I will say, it gives my publicity team something to go to somebody like you or to another media person and say, look, this book hit the list, and so therefore you should do a story about it. And also it does help in certain stores where they have displays based on their bestseller lists. So, again, it's anything that we can use, which is to help promote the books.
There has been speculation that Barnes & Noble may be following Borders and going out of business. Do you think that we're coming to the end of the big bookstores? You don't want to touch that. Okay. Well,
we're all looking.
Small independent bookstores don't have the same pressures that a company as large as Barnes & Noble does. And we used to think of them as endangered. Do you think that the fact that we are seeing the closing of so many chain stores is actually going to be a boon to the independents?
I mean, it feels like the independents do a terrific job, and they're just as there are closings of independents every day, there are openings of independents every day, and they do a terrific job of what they want to do, which is to curate books that their owners and their booksellers love for an audience that they believe in. And I think about that a lot, and it feels like that is – there's a kind of constant ebb and tide of success in opening stores and then closing stores, but it doesn't always seem day-to-day to be related to the opening and closings of big box stores.
Independent publishing is flourishing on the internet. Is that a threat to larger publishing houses like Penguin or HarperCollins?
I don't think so.
Yeah.
In some cases, books have had some success on the internet, and then the publishing houses have picked them up and run with them.
I mean, I think that actually even predates the internet in terms of there's certainly been people who have self-published. And then, I mean, The Celestine Prophecy, I believe, was self-published. Rich Dad, Poor Dad. So, I mean, there's always been a history of that. It's definitely more of the minority than the majority.
Yeah. I'm talking with Amy Einhorn and Ben Schrank about the publishing business today. Both of you work for a big house like Penguin. What are some of the pros and cons of working for one of the big ones? Like, and we've seen more and more conglomeratization. Amy, in your case, your imprint is an imprint in an imprint, isn't it?
My parents don't understand that, but you, yes. So I'm an imprint within a bigger corporation. I would say, to me, the advantage of being at Penguin is, I think, our sales force. In terms of, as opposed to all of the other publishing houses, we have 2 sales forces. We have a sales force that sells for hardcover and a separate one that sells for paperback, which this might be a little bit too insider baseball for people, but it's like if you look at some of the books that our sales force has made into sort of phenomenons, that's really specific to Penguin. And I also just think in terms of Penguin, I think when they did a study of imprimaturs, most people don't really care what's on the spine of a book. But in terms of Penguin as a as an imprimatur, it actually means something to consumers.
Now, how does the sales force make a book into a success when it might not be? I mean, I understand you can take out a big ad in the New York Times, but
I think
you could buy some space on a shelf in a major bookstore?
Well, I think the real the for me the pleasure of being an imprint within a division within the USA based Penguin USA is just that
because the British company is a different company.
Well, there's Penguin Global, and and Penguin USA exists within Penguin Global, which is a division of Pearson, which is a PLC. But the pleasure for me is certainly these are children's division sales and marketing group, and the way that the sales group works with us is that we present these books to them. To speak to our earlier concern, an editor ideally buys a book. It's going to take 10 months to 2 years towards publication. They better be. I always make an analogy to dating. Like, you want to think about it for a long time before you commit, because you're going to really have to be loving that book for a long time. And that, as Amy said, we then present these books to the sales force, and we say we love these books, and then they turn around and they're a force, they're an army, and then they turn around to all these booksellers and say, we love this book, we want it to be huge.
And I would just add that, you know, I know someone once was interviewing me about the success of The Help, and they wanted to know sort of the formula that we use. And I said, you know, look, it's not a sexy story. The story is that actually, you know, we did all this stuff, and my sales force was messianic about this. And, you know, that book did not hit the bestseller list for 6 weeks. We hit number 16 with an asterisk, and then we fell off. And my sales force would not give up. And that's something which is very, very much, I think, specific to Penguin, in that other sales forces would have been like, 6 weeks, 4 weeks, we haven't hit the list, we're on to the next book. And I think people don't really recognize that there's a tremendous amount that goes on between what goes on behind the scenes that you don't see.
Often, not just in the book business, but in any business like the record business, the one that comes out as a hit or has the biggest name on it is the one that everybody gets behind. And a wonderful, smaller thing might get totally ignored. But it didn't hurt that The Help was made into a movie.
But that sells
a lot of books, doesn't it?
Yeah, but that didn't happen. I mean, the book had already been out for 2 years. I think when people say, well, this book came out of nowhere and it became a bestseller, for us, it didn't come out of nowhere. We've been working on these for, you know, years at a time. And there's been a tremendous number of people creating marketing plans, creating covers, all of this, which it wasn't an accident that this just sort of showed up on the bestseller list.
Now, Ben, you're a writer as well. In fact, you have an adult novel. You've done young adult novels?
I've written some young adult novels under a pseudonym, yeah.
And now you have an adult novel coming out next February from Farrah Straus and Giroux.
Yeah, Love Is a Canoe.
Edited by Sarah Crichton, who's actually filled in on the show a couple of
times. Oh,
really? Before she went back to FSG. Now, did you start as a writer, or did you start writing after you were editing?
I really started as a writer and was a writer for many years up until my 30s.
Mm-hmm. And then you needed to make a living.
I wanted to go out to lunch in Manhattan with other people. Yeah, it was lonely in Brooklyn, so I thought I'd make a living and come to the city and meet people like Amy.
And Amy, did you start at the bottom and work your way up, the equivalent of the mailroom, being the person who looked at the books that came in the slush pile?
The mailroom would have been great. When I started FSG, I made $13,000 a year, and I worked as a cleaning lady on the weekends. So I think the mailroom would have been a big promotion.
Did somebody take you under his or her wing?
You know,
how important is mentoring in this business?
Mentoring is very important. And unfortunately, I didn't start working for someone who was very powerful and who was very established early on. So I kind of jumped around a lot. But I did have some great mentors, including Ann Patty and Gina Centrello. So I've worked for some very wonderful people, but I didn't start off working for them.
As the head of an imprint, do you have much time to mentor others?
Yeah, I would say so. The good thing about having an imprint for me is it's much smaller than being the head of a very big list. So the reason why I wanted to do this was I'm able to spend much more time working on my books. And the same token, I'm able to spend much more time with the people who work for me.
Writers say that they rarely get the same kinds of line-by-line reads that were done in the past. How strong a role do you play in your editing?
I always want to respond to this issue.
You've heard it more than once. The other question that writers have is the book is out. Why am I not getting a review?
Why am I not getting a review? Right. And we have more of a – well, there's lots of answers to that question. But in relation to editing, I always want to be like the Hair Club for Men guy in a way, in that I can speak to both sides of this, where as a writer I'm extremely edited, both by my agent and my editor. And as a publisher and editor, we do extensive, huge structural edits on all of the books that we buy, and we really expect – authors to accept that and embrace it all the way through to the line edit and the copy edit and everything else.
But there have been cutbacks in publishing. A friend complained that on a book, the editor sent it back to him and said, it has to lose 130 pages. He said, what do you want me to take out? She said, 130 pages.
I think there's always going to be stories.
That was a big house. publisher.
I will say that before I take on a book, and if I know it needs work, I'll always have a conversation with the author before I buy the book to make sure that they're on board with the changes that I want to do, because there's nothing worse than buying something and then giving someone your editorial notes and then saying, I'm not, you know, this is fine as is. I just think it's sort of, to me, it's sort of a very easy, cheap shot to say editors don't edit.
Well, the Observer article commented on your very strong and lengthy editorial letters and post-it notes. So what kinds of things do you tell a writer?
Oh, gosh, everything. I mean, you know, you're doing everything from line edits where, you know, moving sentences or this line reads awkwardly. So usually what I do is actually I do two things. So I do a structural edit where I'll say, you know, here's what's wrong structurally. And then I do a line by line edit. But I mean, you know, my first editorial letter on The Postmistress, which ended up being a New York Times bestseller, was 17 pages long. So That's why I kind of take a little umbrage at when people say editors don't edit.
Are you tempted, like Ben, to write yourself?
I actually wrote a book years and years and years ago that my mom might be the only person who bought a copy of. But it was great in terms of, I do think all editors should be able to be on the other side, because it gives you incredible empathy for what your authors are going through.
Right.
Now, Ben, how important has Harry Potter been to your side of the business?
I think it's been – certainly Harry Potter has been amazing, and then Twilight, and then The Hunger Games, and these kinds of big blockbusters, certainly, even to speak to the bestseller list, they've brought enormous attention to children's books, and some of that attention has been good and some of it has been bad. I wonder, without Harry Potter, would we be having more fun and even more leeway and freedom to play around and try to do different things possibly? But it does mean that everybody's looking for the next – you know, major, enormous blockbuster, including me.
Well, it changed Scholastic. So I would imagine anybody looking at that saying, I want something like that for myself.
Occasionally comes up in our meetings, why don't you get something like Harry Potter?
My favorite was when we had, in a previous company, they had a McKinsey came, and they said, what you need to do is publish more bestsellers.
Amy Einhorn has her own imprint at Penguin. Ben Schrank is now the president of Razorbill, an imprint of Penguin Young Readers Group. Thank you both so much for being on our show.
Thank you.
It's been more than 20 years since the L.A. riots. On tomorrow's show, Rodney King and his fiancée Cynthia Kelly on what happened that night in March 1991 that caused an international furor. And then Richard Zaks on Teddy Roosevelt's efforts to clean up the seedier parts of New York City in the 1890s. A History of the World in 100 Objects looks at a brass plaque from pre-colonial Benin. Also, writer-director-producer Gary Marshall on his life in the worlds of television and films, plus Werner Herzog on his profiles of five inmates facing lethal injections. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Sarah Waltuck, Jessica Miller, and contributing producer Fran Jacobs. Debbie Fountain was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening, and we will see you tomorrow.